Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
40 years ago, they were a wonder. The tallest twins in the world.
At 110 stories, the twin towers of the World Trade Center dominate the New York City skyline.
A city within the city that imagined itself the engine of global commerce back in 1977 when this film was made.
50,000 people work in these buildings, traveling here from all over the metropolitan area.
Built on the bedrock of Lower Manhattan, the towers stood until they fell in flames on September 11th, 2001. That act of destruction and its aftermath is commemorated in the National September 11 Memorial Museum, being dedicated today by President Obama and a small group of survivors, rescue workers, and family members of the victims. A museum to show something that is gone. That small group of invited guests, in a way, frames the unique challenge for this public space. Politicians, first responders, victims, it will be visited by millions of people, all with very different points of view about the events. The museum itself is built next to that ancient bedrock, 70 feet below the surface that once anchored the towers, and it's sacred ground. The pieces of debris and artifacts, all vessels for imagining the lives lost on that day. How to make an interpretive site that is meaningful to all without being offensive or deeply upsetting to some, all while keeping the clarity of the events in focus, was the central challenge for the designers, which is why on the museum design team was a clinical psychologist, Dr. Billy Pivnik, who joins us now. Welcome, doctor.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
How did you begin making choices about what to do and what not to do as you approached this design problem?
We wanted to be able to commemorate, honor, mourn, and memorialize the people who were lost and the people who survived through great distress. And we wanted to do it in a way that didn't overstimulate people and take them back to the feelings that they may have had on 9/11 itself, wherever they were, since so many people witnessed the events live, whether on TV or, you know, close by in Manhattan. I could see the buildings from my office and saw the collapse. So we wanted to be able to evoke enough of the sense of shock, but also allow people to be able to think and reflect about it.
The late Yamazaki, the architect, dedicated the buildings to world peace. And that quote, astonishing now, is there in the museum. How surprised were you by the message that the artifacts began to give off once they were put in the museum space? Some of them, while you might think they would be grisly, are in fact quite somber.
I saw most of the artifacts in the airplane hangar at JFK before they were placed in the museum. So I knew they had stories to tell. But they were largely stories that were devoid of verbs, right? There was no life there. It was just shocking to see 80,000 square feet of steel with no life connected to them. And, you know, bicycle racks torqued from the impact with twisted bicycles, but no people. So I think the artifacts came to stand in for people who were witnesses, who obviously wouldn't have survived at such close proximity. And, you know, I think they evoke sadness, they evoke tenderness, they evoke anger. You know, they're quite articulate, even though they're mute.
What kinds of questions did the architects and, builders ask you about? How did that collaboration work? How did they consult with you? What did you tell them? Maybe this direction, not that direction.
It was a very, very interesting process. I think the first step was creating a common language, since psychology and design are very different languages. And it soon became evident that I could see things in some of the plans and drafts of designs that they didn't see because they weren't looking at them really psychologically.
For instance?
Well, at one point, there was a structure that they were building to scaffold some photographs or something like that. And it was very flat. And Tom Hennis, the lead designer, was very frustrated with the process. And he grabbed a piece of wood and walked across the office and jammed it into a piece of foam core board. And he said, "This is what's missing." And this was not the board, obviously. It was the violence. And it turned out that the things that we were all sensitive to avoid so that we wouldn't be re-traumatizing visitors was that violence, right? The shock. From a psychological point of view, he was enacting something that no one really had put into words because of the trauma. It had been disconnected from the verbal narrative, and it had to be carried in action. And this is something we see in the treatment of traumatized people, and you would expect something like that to happen when one is trying to create the scaffolding for a narrative about a mass trauma.
So you have to embrace the violence on some level, signify it.
Correct. And once you see it and signify it, you can return it to the verbal narrative, and then it's no longer so shocking. Then it's symbolized. You know, it can be told as a story.
Where does that trauma go? Does it level out and become like other historical artifacts and memorials here in New York? What will it be like, you know, 50 years, 100 years from now?
Oh,
have you thought of that?
It's such an interesting question. I don't know if you're familiar with the intersection in London that's called Charing Cross.
Mm-hmm.
It began well over 100 years ago as a memorial. And it was originally Cheren, C-H-E-R-E and R-E-I-N-E, Dear Queen. And I don't even remember which war it memorializes, frankly. But as you see, it's now called Charing Cross, and nobody even remembers that it began as a memorial. So these things are destined, actually, eventually to lose some of their punch. And that's because they serve their purpose. They enfold the living into the community, you know, the community into the living, and dialogue can be restored. You know, people who were suffering feel that they're witnessed, that their pain was witnessed. People who weren't present feel like they could be at the site and kind of touch it and be part of history. And it kind of brings the world together. So eventually it can be. The idea is to make it more present so that eventually it can be more absent. It can be mourned and let go of.
On a river of tears, a journey from remembering to forgetting.
Yes, on a journey of tears.
Dr. Billy Pivnik is a clinical psychologist who worked closely with the 9/11 museum designers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.